Good evening. My name is Bryn McNamee Tweed, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum student project managers, the Clark Forum student board, and student senate, I would like to welcome you to the kickoff event of our two-day hip-hop symposium, How You Gonna Be the King of New York? As the Washington Post has recently reported, African-American men consciously must work to offset stereotypes about them, in particular that they are dangerous, aggressive, and angry. Scholars of hip-hop and black popular culture have studied and analyzed the roots of this stereotype. These studies have reopened the general issues of how black men should conduct themselves in American society today. One of the most prominent issues regarding this topic is the role that masculinity plays in black popular culture. To address this general topic, we're fortunate to have Mark Anthony Neal, a professor of black popular culture in the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. In addition to his role as instructor, Neal is a prominent scholar on issues of homophobia and masculinity in black popular culture. He's the author of four books, including What the Music Said, Black Popular Music and Black Popular Culture, Soul Babies, Black Popular Culture and the Post-Soul Aesthetic, and most recently, New Black Man, Rethinking Black Masculinity. Neal is also the co-editor of That's the Joint, the Hip Hop Studies Reader. Neal's essays have appeared in DeCapo Best Music Writing, as well as the 2009 edition of Best African American Essays. Besides print, he's a frequent contributor to National Public Radio and has appeared in Byron Hurt's acclaimed documentary, Hip Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes, and the BBC's Soul Deep, The Story of Black Popular Music. At this time, I would like to remind all audience members to silence all cell phones and other electronic devices. At the end of tonight's event, there will be a short question and answer session. Out of respect for audience members who may be hearing impaired and because the event is being taped, we ask that you wait until the microphone reaches you before posing a question. And now, please join me in welcoming Mark Anthony Neal.
Good evening. How's everyone doing? So the title of my talk is, How Are You Going to Be the King of New York? And it's a line from a song called You Gotta Love It, from a hip-hop artist by the name of Cam'ron. The piece that I'm going to read to you this evening to talk about it is part of a larger book project called Looking for Leroy. Leroy would be the character of Leroy from the film and television series Fame. And very much like Isaac Julian did with the concept of Langston Hughes in his film Looking for Langston, I'm using Leroy as kind of a jump-off point to talk about performances of black masculinity as legible and illegible. The backstory is that as a 15-year-old growing up in the South Bronx, this would be 1980, Rapper's Delight is already out. Hip-hop is already transforming literally the landscape. And I was a different kind of Negro, right? Traveling to Brooklyn every day with my pastel tennis shirts, Le Tigre, or because Le Tigre is more affordable than Izod Lacoste, and my matching pastel hosiery, and my penny loafers with shiny new pennies that I diligently changed every 2 weeks. Meanwhile, my peers are wearing quarter fields and leather bombers and unlaced Pumas, you know, so I was an odd cat, right, in the South Bronx in 1980. So when Fame debuted, I was immediately struck by the character of Leroy, which was played by the late actor Gene Anthony Ray. And there was something about him, right? This is a cat that was wearing cornrows and really tight shorts, but yet there was something hyper-masculine about his performance, right? And as you go through kind of the back narratives, both in the film and the story, you know, Leroy clearly had a hood pass. But yet my immediate way to read Leroy is, well, you know, this cat actually, he has to be gay, right? Because there's no other way for me to read him. And I always thought that was odd, right? Because as a cat who was regularly queered because of my choices, I found it odd that immediately I went to that in trying to read Leroy. Of course, the other thing I was dealing with at this like little 15-year-old boy is like, okay, the last time I checked, I was a heterosexual, but damn, this cat looks like kind of attractive. And so a lot of this project, right, the first chapter, which deals with, you know, Leroy on fame, and there's a chapter on Jay-Z, which we'll talk about this evening, chapter on the great stage actor and television actor Avery Brooks, chapter on Stringer Bell, Idris Elba's character from The Wire. A lot of this is really motivated by what I'll call a man crush, right? And I got a serious man crush on Jay-Z, which we'll talk about this evening. How are you going to be the king of New York? In the mid-1980s, the images of shell-top Adidas velour running suits, gold chains, and Kangol caps, as literally embodied by the group Run-DMC, were synonymous with hip-hop culture. But as hip-hop culture moved into different commercial and discursive markets, hip-hop fashion has become more diverse. The examples of Tommy Hilfiger, purportedly the first major designer to take notice of hip-hop's potential in terms of selling fashion, and black designer Karl Kani, are regularly cited as critical to a shift in hip-hop fashion, where, quote, trends were specifically created for hip-hop markets. But as critic Nicole Fleetwood notes, contemporary hip-hop fashion is often wrought with ambivalences and anxiety. Citing the work of fashion critic and theorist Fred Davis, Fleetwood argues that, quote, ambivalences over the identities that represent hip-hop fashion are critical to the successful marketing of hip-hop fashion. She writes, the role of ambivalence in hip-hop fashion does not stop with the product itself, the marketing campaign, the possible desires and fantasy of its consumers, or the media coverage of the industry and its figureheads, but also plays out in the struggle of hip-hop fashion producers to signify racialized alterity through their products and to be embraced by mainstream American culture. The ambivalences that Fleetwood references are easily correlated with some of the anxieties associated with contemporary hip-hop culture in general. Fleetwood suggests that these anxieties are in part related to the fears of artists and other representational figures within hip-hop of being marginalized as ethnic, or some of the identity construction that marks them as non-American at a moment when hip-hop's stake in Americana is so pronounced. Among elite producers and consumers, anxieties related to belonging are further amplified given the general societal apprehensions about citizenship in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. Think how seamlessly Curtis 50 Cent Jackson's rags-to-riches narrative was cast as emblematic of the American dream. This partly explains the move by hip-hop's elite fashion producers from so-called urban culture, urban fashion, to that which could be described as upscale or even metrosexual, in the case of male fashion. For elite hip-hop icons like Russell Simmons, Sean Combs, and Jay-Z, the shift from urban to upscale mirrors their own ascendance into the higher echelon of American celebrity culture. This shift initially evident in the work of Jay-Z in the music video for Excuse Me, Miss. This shift is initially evident in the work of Jay-Z in the music video for Excuse Me, Miss. The video's primary labor is to articulate the branding power of Jay-Z, but I argue that it also provides a transitory landscape to read the emotional and existential complexities that mainstream rap music largely and consciously obscures. So for those of you who've never seen Excuse Me,
can I get my grow in? You can't roll it to this one. You gotta puff it on this one. You can't even drink Cristal on this one. You got drink Cristal. Woo! Try some red wine, little guy, so 9/7. This is for the grown and sexy.
Excuse me. What's your name?
Can I get my grown in on the one since I see some ladies tonight? This should be hanging with Jay-Z. Jay-Z. Excuse me, miss. What's your name? Uh-huh. Can you come hang with me? Oh, possibly. That's right. Can I take you out tonight? You already know what it's hitting for. I got whatever outside, and you know what I'm sitting on. 50-50 venture with them S-dots kicking off. Armadale popping now. Only bringing them all. Only thing missing is the missus. You ain't even gotta do the dishes. Got two dishwashers. Got one chef, one maid. All I need is a part and a place space with the cards up. All trust. Who else you gonna run with? The truth is us. Only dudes moving units. M. Pimp juicing us.
It's the rockin' hair. Maybach outside, got rocks in air. PJs on the runway, young got air. I don't land at an airport, I call it the clipboard. Therefore, I don't wanna hear more. Back and forth about who's hottest, young holla.
Excuse me.
This one can't roll up to this one, boy.
You're so contagious, I can't take it. I'm a baby, let's just make it. Excuse me, what's your name?
Since I see some ladies tonight, this should be rolling with Jason.
Lady, what's your name?
I see some ways tonight, this shit be rolling with Jason. Everybody's like, he's no item. Please don't like him. He don't wife him. He one nights him. Now she don't like him. She never met him. Groupies try to take advantage of him. He won't let him. He don't need him. So he treats him like he treats him. Better them than me. She don't agree with him. She's mad at that. He's not having that. So those opposites attract like magnets. She sees more than the Benz wagon. The friends tagging along with a flashy brag on the song. She gets a glimpse of Sean and she likes that. He too weighs her, so she writes back. Smiley faces after all of her phrases. Either she the one or I'm caught in the matrix. Let the fish burn. Red or green pill. You live and you learn. Come on.
Excuse me. Damn.
You gotta throw in your fine linens for this one.
So contagious, I can't take it.
You might have gotta go pitch some Scooby Doos. Got them in the Scooby Doos. Those are shoes, by the way.
So contagious, I can't take it. Help my baby, let's just make it. Excuse me, what's your name?
It's for the grown and sexy. Only for the grown and sexy.
Lady, what's your name?
Love, let's go half on the sun. I know my past ain't won. You can easily get past, but that chapter is done. But I'm done reading for now. Remember space, face up, you could believe it for now. But ma, you got it for real, for serious, bro. I'm about to give you all the keys and security codes. About to show you where the cheese, let you know I ain't playing. But before I jump out the window, what's your name?
I'm gonna stop it there. In an effort to tweak the accepted uniform of the so-called hip-hop thug, Jay-Z and other artists signed to the Rockefeller label appear in the video for Excuse Me, Miss, donning business suits. With Jay-Z uttering phrases like, this is for the grown and sexy, and can I get my grown man on throughout, the video anticipates the emergence of the hip-hop metrosexual as exemplified by artists like Kanye West, Andre 3000, and Pharrell Williams. In the context of hip-hop, these men are not quite the mirror men that journalist Mark Simpson talks about, but rather men whose consumption habits, particularly within the realm of fashion, are akin to those that mainstream American society generally assigns to women. The attention to highbrow style throughout the video, directed by Lil X, is an attempt to identify Jay-Z and other members of the Rockefeller clique as exceptional men, among the cliched archetypes of black masculinity that have historically circulated within hip-hop culture. The video also links the Rockefeller brand to an earlier, more classic moment within hip-hop, when it wasn't unusual to see hip-hop artists such as Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Houdini and the Sugar Hill Gang wearing dress suits. In the context of establishing Rockaware as a brand of exceptional men, that Jay-Z is, of course, established as the most exceptional among exceptional men. The song and video for Excuse Me, Miss are rife with product placements referencing to S-Dots with S-Dot Carter sneaker collection, Armadale, a Scottish-produced vodka that is distributed in the United States by Rockefeller, and Zeno Platinum Crowns, upscale cigars targeted to hip-hop generation consumers. What links these products is Jay-Z's relationship with Peter Arnell, chief creative officer of the Arnell Group, specialist in quote-unquote product creation and brand invention, and Steve Stout, longtime music industry executive, who with Arnell formed PASS, P-A-S-S, an agency dedicated to linking high-end producers with hip-hop consumers. The S.Dot Carter collection is Arnell and Stout's most visible success, with the Reebok product generating more than $100 million in sales. According to Arnell, quote, we create proprietary intellectual capital that is fresh and desirable to the public. While Jay-Z's ability to hawk for Arnell's clients is obvious here, I'd like to argue that Excuse Me, Miss helps establish Jay-Z as a proprietary intellectual property. But what is being bought and sold in Jay-Z is proprietary intellectual property. The branding of Jay-Z as an elite product, of course. But less pronounced is Jay-Z's attempt, a simple gesture really, to broaden the contours of a commercially viable black masculinity. Notable about Jay-Z's gestures is that he has chosen to do so in the context of branding, thus making claims on a progressive notion of hip-hop masculinity at the level of consumption. Realistically, the image of hardcore hip-hop acts wearing Armani suits would not be notable if the images were not buttressed by the musical narrative, Excuse Me, Miss, created by Jay-Z and collaborator Pharrell Williams. That's Pharrell Williams who's singing the hook in the video. Excuse Me, Miss borrows from the chorus of Luther Vandross' song, Take Me Out. With Vandross as a referent here, I'd like to suggest that Pharrell Williams' deliberate use of the elements of Take You Out creates a narrative which destabilizes the accepted heteromasculine narrative of the song and video. Vandross never publicly responded to queries about his sexuality when he was alive, but it was widely believed among audiences and industry peers that he was in fact gay. Vandross often appeared opposite women in the music videos, but his recording company, perhaps sensing how palpable questions about his sexuality were becoming, blatantly attempted to heterosexualize Vandross's image for the video for Take You Out, the lead single from his 2001 recording Luther Vandross. Thus, Vandross appeared in the video for Take Me Out wearing Sean John clothing. He's a 50-year-old man at this point. A normative masculinity tailored just for Vandross while pursuing the actress Garcelle Beauvais. The creation of a romantic video from the album was reminiscent of the relationship created for former New York City Mayor Ed Koch and former Miss America Bess Meyerson to quiet rumors of Koch's homosexuality when he was an emerging national political figure in the mid-1970s. Rather than challenge belief about Vandross' sexuality, the video for Take You Out became a visual representation of the down-low narrative. The incidence of black men being on the down-low, or the DL, has sensationalized existing anxieties within black communities about homosexuality and rising HIV rates among black populations, particularly black women. This particular aspect of the song, Take Me Out, was later reinforced via a club remix which sampled Snoop Dogg's song, Lay Low, providing yet another layer to read Vandross' sexuality. But I'd like to make a fine point here regarding notions of being on the down low by suggesting that in the context of hip-hop's hypermasculinity, notions of a homosexual body, any homosexual body, laying in the cut, is an all-too-obvious reductive reading. Taking license with hip-hop's own genealogy with the cut, the creative tensions that produced the innovations of Grandmaster Flash and Grand Wizard Theodore in the process, transforming Kool Herc's sound system aesthetic into a legitimate art form, I'd like to read Pharrell's use of Take You Out as evidence of the levels of complexity that almost always resides in the crevices of mainstream popular culture if one is willing to submit of the illegibility of it all. Rather than read Excuse Me, Miss, as simply a celebration of the bling that Jay-Z celebrity and branding power affords, I'd like to suggest that there is a performative labor associated with bling beyond its ability to provide access to the radio and video outlets that mainstream rappers found absolutely necessary for crossover appeal. In other words, I'd like to suggest that in line with bling's singular attribute, it literally blinds audiences and critical readers to the complexities that lay in the cut. In fact, this blindness is more than a residual effect of artists trying to provide a nuanced and progressive performance in the full glare of mainstream popular culture, but that it also concretely related to attempts by artists and critics to make a progressive politics illegible in an era when anxieties about the legibility of such politics are heightened. Set in a nightclub, Excuse Me, Miss opens with Jay-Z and his entourage being greeted by the gaze of virtually every woman, all conveniently scantily clad in the club. The club setting establishes one of the defining cliches of rap music at the time, as expressed on a track like Do It Again, Put Your Hands Up from Jay-Z's 1999 recording, Volume 3, The Life and Times of S. Dot Carter. On the track, Jay-Z and label mate Beanie Siegel, who's also in this video, make explicit references to the kinds of sexual favors they receive from women at clubs, all ostensibly related to the celebrity and social capital that even second-rate rappers are thought to possess. The critical action in the Excuse Me, Miss video occurs in an elevator, where Jay-Z is rendered speechless, he literally bites his lip, by an attractive woman, an embodiment of bling, who enters the elevator. As such, I would also like to argue that there is something of significance to the fact that Jay-Z's fantasy occurs in the proverbial closeted space, an elevator. Rather than use Jay-Z's heterosexual gaze to construct another cliche of black male objectification of black female sexuality, director Little X employs Jay-Z's gaze to feel a romantic fantasy where the rapper imagines that this woman is the one, the love of his life. Here, the director has established a broader context beyond the bling to catch a glimpse of Sean. Jay-Z's fantasy, in part simply a longing to be just Sean, ends when the rapper utters the line, "I'm about to give you all the keys and security codes, but before I jump out the window, what's your name?" Within the narrative of the video, Jay-Z wakes from his fantasy, still speechless, as he and the woman exit the elevator. Referencing Fred Moten here, I'd like to argue that Jay-Z's query, "What's your name?" is the invocation of the lack of language available to represent the politics and poetics of a cosmopolitan masculinity in contemporary rap music. Marlon Ross suggests that, quote, "The closet has become ground zero in the project of articulating an epistemology of sexuality," adding that the closet has also become a philosophical concept grounding both lesbian gay history and queer theory by joining them at the hips as a legitimate academic discipline, unquote. To this point, Maurice Wallace adds, quote, "If what we imagine as a closeted body may be racialized to the indifference of sexual speculation, the singularly gay character of the closet no longer holds," unquote. I cite Ross and Wallace here to make a collateral point that the closet is also a site for the production of knowledge, particularly in consideration of Jay-Z as a proprietary intellectual property. If the closet has become the most visible metaphor for those identities beyond the legibility of a vastly heteronormative, homophobic, and patriarchal society, I want to claim that the elevator is yet another metaphor for closeted identities. But whereas the space of the closet remains largely static, the elevator as mobile, if only hierarchically, is, in other words, the elevator renders the spatial logic of the closet as cosmopolitan when one considers issues of mobility and the fact that bodies are often in flux, the literal comings and goings within the space of the elevator. The potential for reading Jay-Z through the parameters of the cosmopolitan closet is further buttressed by his own fixation with the comic book hero Superman. Kingdom Come, which was his aptly named comeback album from 2006, following Jay-Z's so-called retirement, follows the release of his 2003 recording, The Black Album. Kingdom Come is also the title of a Superman comic written by Mark Waid, in which the mythical figure returns from his own retirement. Where Superman returns to save the world, Jay-Z's charge was to save hip-hop. On the recording's title track, Jay-Z makes explicit claims on the Superman myth as he states, "Up in the office, you may know him as Clark. Just when you thought the whole world fell apart, I take off the blazer, loosen up the tie, step inside the booth, Superman is alive," unquote. Of particular interest here is Jay-Z's deployment of the space of the booth. In the traditional narrative, Clark Kent usually changes into Superman in a phone booth. A closet space in its own right, the phone booth is also representative of a site that of both transformation and communication. But in an era of cell phones, the phone booth is more of an antiquated trinket to a bygone past. Of course, the booth is also a reference to the location in a recording studio where performers lay down and record their vocal tracks. Jay-Z's invitation to step inside the booth retains both the phone booth's original metaphoric value as a site of transformation and communication, while transferring the literal function of the phone booth into the recording studio. Within the context of Kingdom Come, the recording booth functions as a closeted cosmopolitan space writ large for public consumption. In the cases of Excuse Me, Miss, and Kingdom Come, the closet cosmopolitan space renders Jay-Z's embodied queerness as palpable within the context of mainstream hypermasculine hip-hop, where he can only be queered in the most idiosyncratic ways. Such was the case when Jay-Z confronted longtime business partner Damon Dash in an elevator shortly after the two had dissolved their professional relationship and Jay-Z had become president of Island Def Jam Records. According to Dash, and this was an article in Rolling Stone, he ran into Jay-Z in an elevator. Quote, "Jay was coming from whatever he was doing at Def Jam, and he had on a suit with shoes and a trench coat, and I had on my state property clothing line, and my hat was to the side. It was ill. Our conversation was brief, wasn't no malice, but he was not the same person I had met. I would never expect him to wear a trench coat and shoes." In the context of Damon Dash's description, simple apparel like a pair of shoes and a trench coat
were enough evidence that somehow Jay-Z had changed. The implication here was that Jay-Z was no longer real in the sense that mainstream hip-hop traffics in the real, as emblematic of the overwrought caricatures of black masculinity that had become one of hip-hop's most treasured commodities. Festering beneath Dash's somewhat benign comments was the fact that as part of Jay-Z's negotiation to take over Island Def Jam, he accepted part ownership of the Rockefeller label that he co-founded with Dash and Kareem Biggs. The trio sold the label to Universal Music Group, Island Records, Def Jam's parent company, only the year before. Dash was later divested of his interest in the Rockaware clothing line for more than $20 million. Jay-Z later sold the clothing line for more than $200 million while retaining creative control. After the initial break, Dash admitted some disappointment and acknowledged that, quote, "It's business, but we were supposed to be more about more than business." Dash's hurt was later masked when he appeared in a video for Cam'ron's You Got to Love It, where the rapper serves as a mouthpiece for Dash's grievances and attempts a public queering of Jay-Z at the level of footwear. This would be our friend Cam'ron, and this would be the vocals, the musical vocal audio track for the song. And I'm only gonna play the intro.
Before I set it off, okay. First off, you a bitch, nigga. Only reason I'm doing this, I'ma just name five reasons real quick. Got 150. First, stole Rockefeller from Dane. Second, you stole Kanye from Dane. Third, you stole Rockaway from Dane. Fourth, I seen the nigga throw that diamond up before them shots was fired. Fifth, hold on, turn the beat off. I had to turn the beat off for this. You talking about you an 80s baby. You 37 years old. You was born in 1968. And I opened the Daily News. How's the king of New York rocking sandals with jeans? Open toe sandals with chancletas with jeans on. How's the king of New York rocking sandals with jeans and he 42 years old? Back to biz, you ain't the only one with big wallets. Got it, my shit's proud, got it.
How you gonna be the king of New York was the implication of a simple query that was directed towards Jay-Z by former Rockefeller artist Cam'ron. In an industry where rappers regularly challenge the status and stature of other rappers, Cam'ron's question seems innocuous. More specifically, though, Cam'ron asked, how the king of New York rocking sandals with jeans, open-toe sandals with chancletas with jeans on, how the king of New York rocking sandals with jeans and he 42 years old, and in the process enacted a very public queering of Jay-Z. The stimulus for Cam'ron's attacks were grievances outlined in the spoken introduction, specifically related to the split between Jay-Z and Damon Dash, who was responsible for signing Cam'ron to Rockefeller against Jay-Z's wishes. As he accuses Jay-Z of stealing Rockefeller, the label, Kanye West, one of the label's best-selling artists, and Rockaware from Dash. Though he distanced himself from Cam'ron's comments, Damon Dash was not dissuaded from appearing in the video for Got to Love It. The basic premise of Cam'ron's attack is that Jay-Z's choice of footwear, homophobia rendered at the level of the conceptual, was not reflective of someone who should lay a claim on being the king of New York, the best rapper in New York, a title that legendary rappers such as Nas and the late Notorious B.I.G. have also laid claim to. The quip about open-toe sandals was in reference to a picture of Jay-Z that appeared in a New York City daily. Cam'ron's query comes from towards the end of a spoken introduction to Got to Love It and follows a more explicit querying of Jay-Z at the song's opening, where Cam'ron refers to Jay-Z as a bitch nigger, a well-circulated pejorative that feminizes Jay-Z on a more literal level. With his later description of Rockaware as cockaware, Cam'ron's You Got to Love It functions as little more than a homophobic rant directed at an artist who, because of his public heterosexual persona, can only be queered figuratively on the basis that he was not keeping it real enough. In his work on authenticity in hip-hop, rapper and critic Timon West suggests that slogans like quote-unquote keep it real and others that index some notion of authenticity in hip-hop are related to the anxieties produced by an increased presence of women and non-black male rappers in mainstream contemporary rap. Quote, but is the real ever really real? West facetiously asks, noting that, quote, the real must be perpetually managed and kept in check by those who want to secure hip-hop's connection to straight black and Latino men, to the straight black and Latino men who started hip-hop. But the straightness of the men of early hip-hop is questionable. though those vested with authority to control hip-hop's image would prefer that none of us believe this, unquote. While the term questionable suggests a familiarity with a generation of men that I believe we are not really all that familiar with, West's point is well taken. One's identity and thus sexuality are always up for negotiation, but given the ongoing conflation of hip-hop, most pronounced in commercial rap music, and hypermasculinity, there are many who presume that the men who became the public face of hip-hop's origins would have to be straight. This line of thinking is buttressed by a rarely disturbed assumption that the foundational generation of hip-hoppers would be, of course, responsible for the most authentic or purest forms of hip-hop. The very questioning of the stability of hypermasculinity in hip-hop manifests an anxiety that demands the presence of a queer figure in order to reconstitute hypermasculine figure that is at the mythical center of hip-hop discourse. The sheer volume and quickness with which many make claims on hip-hop authenticity in the contemporary moment explains the vigor with which the hypermasculine queer dichotomy is maintained within hip-hop. The point here is that within hip-hop discourse, queer is an open signifier that is deployed whenever and wherever the pages of mainstream tabloids, for instance, the myth of hypermasculinity within hip-hop is being challenged. Rapper Benny Siegel's comments in the film Before are exemplary of this regard. Asked about figures like Kanye West and Pharrell Williams, artists that he had worked with in the past, Siegel responds, quote, "Them dudes is not cool. That's not cool to be in the hood. They hold image. Who would want to be that? You wearing Louis Vuitton driving shoes? Who dresses like that?" Finally, tauntingly encouraging the doodle to come way out the closet, homeboy. Here, Siegel jettisons the metaphoric power of the closet by producing, in his mind at least, the bodies ensconced within them. Thus, even Siegel's homophobia adheres to a keep-it-real mantra as he questions the masculinity manhood of those who might be closeted while undermining their authenticity in the event they might actually come out. For those who refuse to yield to the hypermasculine dictates of contemporary rap music, there's literally no place to exist in an industry which seemingly demands their silencing and removal. Timon West observes that, quote, "Hip-hop culture has been compelled to shift in order to give expression to women and non-blacks. The homosexual becomes a figure indicating the proverbial death of hip-hop." In the context of Cam'ron's rant, the King of New York with his open-toed sandals is evidence of that death of hip-hop. Cam'ron's comments are also clearly intended to facilitate the social death of Jay-Z within the context of a culture in which the literal death, particularly at the hands of gun violence, takes on a mythical proportion. Michael Eric Dyson observes that many black youth, quote unquote, accept the black inevitability of death's imminent swoop, which in truth is a rejection of the arbitrariness we all face, since death to these youth is viewed as a condition, not the culmination of their existence. In the context of Dyson's observations, I'd like to suggest that Jay-Z was cognizant of the inevitability of his social death and thus used the video for the track 99 Problems, purportedly his last at the time, as a vehicle in which he ultimately gains control of his legacy within hip-hop by rendering his own social death.
If you having girl problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. I got the rat patrol on the cat patrol. Foes that want to make sure my cask is closed. Rat critics save money, cash holes. I'm from the hood, stupid. What type of facts are those? If you grew up with holes in your zap of toes, you celebrate the minute you was having dope. I'm like, fuck critics, you can kiss my whole asshole. If you don't like my lyrics, you can press fast forward. Got beef with radio, if I don't play they show, they don't play my hits. Well, I don't give a shit, so Rap Max trying to use my black ass so advertisers could give them more cash for ads, fuckers. I don't know what you take me as or understand the intelligence that Jay-Z has. I'm from rags to riches, niggas, I ain't dumb. I got 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. Hit me! 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. Hope you having girl problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. Hit me! Yeah, it's 94 and my trunk is raw. In my rear view mirror is the motherfucking law. Got two choices, y'all. Pull over the car or bounce on the devil, put the pedal to the floor. And I ain't trying to see no highway chase with Jake. Plus, I got a few dollars, I could fight the case. So I pull over to the side of the road, I heard, son, do you know I'm stopping you for? Cause I'm young and I'm black and my hat's real low. Do I look like a mind reader, sir? I don't know. Am I under arrest? should I guess some more?
Well, you was doing 55 in the 54. Lost the registration and step out of the car. You carrying a weapon on you, I know a lot of you are.
I ain't stepping out of shit, all my papers legit.
Well, do you mind if I look around the car a little bit?
Well, my glove compartment is locked, so is the trunk in the back. And I know my rights, so you gon' need a warrant for that.
Aren't you sharp attack? You some type of law or something, somebody important or something.
I ain't past the bar, but I know a little bit enough that you wanna legally search my shit.
Well, we'll see how smart you are when the K-9 comes.
I got 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one.
Hit me!
99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. If you having girl problems, I'll come back for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. Hit me! 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. If you having girl problems, I'll come back for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. Long ago, a nigga like myself had a strong arm, a hoe. This is not a hoe in the sense of having a pussy, but a pussy having no goddamn sense, try and push me. I try to ignore him, talk to the Lord, pray for him, but some fools just love to perform. You know the type, loud as a motorbike, but wouldn't bust a grape in a fruit fight. And only thing that's gonna happen is I'ma get the clapping, and he and his boys gonna be yapping to the captain. And there I go trapped in a Kit Kat again. Back through the system with the riffraff again. Beans on the floor, scratching again. Paparazzis with their cameras snapping them. DA try to give a nigga shaft again. Half a meal for bail cause I'm African. All because the fool was harassing them. Trying to play the boy like he's saccharine. But ain't none sweet, but I hold my gun. I got 99 problems being a bitch ain't one. Hit me! 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. If you having girl problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. Hit me. But a bitch ain't one. If you having girl problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. Hit me. Woo! You crazy for this one, Rick? It's your boy.
With Brooklyn, New York as a backdrop, the black and white video for 99 Problems features a cavalcade of disparate images of New York City. And its residents, ski mask kids, a group of bikers, a fraternity step team, frontally nude black male prisoners being hosed down, the actor Vincent Gallo, a gospel choir, pit bulls, a Hasidic Jew, a man in a coffin, Def Jam co-founder Rick Rubin, and of course Jay-Z, who is depicted walking through a record shop, performing in a darkly lit space, sitting in the living room, presumably of the Marcy Project apartment he once lived in as a child. The wedding picture of his Hispanic couple adorns the wall behind him, and being stopped by the cops in a car he is driving with Rick Rubin. Jay-Z's movement throughout embodies the very notions of flow that his vocal liberty has been celebrated for. Critic Armand White writes that the video, quote, is a strong, strangely beautiful fiction that subverts hip-hop cliche. In the context of the totems of black urban life that have been consistently circulated in rap music videos, director Mark Romanek presents an urban landscape that is decidedly cosmopolitan. As White describes it, quote, Romanek's structure shifts from borough to borough, playground to jailhouse, a series of interlocking actions from a crazy quilt travelogue of New York City that Jay-Z, of course, is all too comfortable in navigating. In the context of the song and the video, it's not surprising that Jay-Z would thus embrace a cosmopolitan or Afropolitan subjectivity, half a meal for Bell because I'm an African. Notably, Jay-Z's use of the term African is framed within the context of a politicized subjectivity produced in response to the realities of the criminal justice system. Jay-Z's confrontation with the police officer earlier in the video is another example of this, where my glove compartment is locked, so the trunk in the back, and you're going to have to need a warrant for that. Jay-Z's gestures here are concessions to a larger gesture. In 99 Problems, images and words become a wrecking ball against the familiar edifice of ghetto fabulousness, determinism, as White argues, to which I would add that Jay-Z is the embodiment of that wrecking ball. In his book on the late rapper Tupac Shakur,
Dyson takes notes of the ways that young black gang members meet with funeral directors to plan their own funerals. Given the presumed inevitability of their deaths, a premium is placed on portraying their dead bodies with a style which may defeat their long being forgotten and distinguishes them from the next corpse. However inevitable they view their own demise, these young men can't realistically predict their own deaths. Thus, in the planning of their own funeralization, with all the excesses one might expect, grants them some agency. In contrast, as a highly successful commercial artist functioning within an industry in which reality is largely constructed for mass consumption, Jay-Z possesses an agency that working class and impoverished black youth can only imagine. Nevertheless, Jay-Z goes at great lengths to stylize his own murder in the video for 99 Problems. In the closing moments of the video, Jay-Z is depicted being shot multiple times from an unknown assailant. The gunshots themselves punctuate the very rhythm track that Jay-Z performs over, and thus highlight the stylized nature of the depiction. The shooting occurs in front of a gated church, Jay-Z perhaps repenting on behalf of his vocation and his masculine privilege, hence the need to murder him at this point. This is clearly a performance, or one that consciously treads on some of the major discursive concerns of contemporary hip-hop, particularly in relationship to the hip-hop elite. For example, rappers Christopher the Notorious B.I.G. Wallace, a mentor to Jay-Z and Tupac Shakur, were immortalized in the aftermath of their murders to the extent that the two were often viewed as the pinnacle of the hip-hop elite. It is a commonly held belief among hip-hop purists that all that has gone wrong over commercialization, materialism, etc., within hip-hop, commercial hip-hop, can be traced to the still unsolved murders of the duo. In fact, a major conceit of the Black Album was that Jay-Z had finally surpassed Wallace as the best rapper to New York. I'm not a writer, I'm a writer for myself and others. I say a big verse, I'm not only bigging up my brother, bigging up my borough, I'm big enough to do it. I'm just that thorough. In addition, at the time that Jay-Z recorded the Black Album, Curtis 50 Cent Jackson had established himself as a best-selling artist, ultimately selling 10 million copies of his debut recording, Get Rich or Die Trying. A major factor in the success of Jackson was his backstory, which included surviving an attempted murder on his life. He was shot 9 times. Thus, the image of Jay-Z being shot multiple times in the video for 99 Problems was clearly intended to make a claim on his legacy in relationship to Shakur, Wallace, and Jackson. But I'd like to suggest that Jay-Z is after more than simply establishing his legacy among hip-hop's elite. On his 1999 track, There's Been a Murder, Jay-Z details aspects of his creative process, with a particular emphasis on his hustling instincts. Creatively, it was, quote-unquote, Sean Carter that fueled the imagination of Jay-Z. Quote, I gotta do Sean because even when Jay-Z was lukewarm, I was getting my loot on. And as the rapper admits, he metaphorically murders his commercial persona to get his mind right, if you will. Back to Sean Carter, the hustler, Jay-Z is dead. Much of the early press surrounding the release of Jay-Z's retirement disc suggested that the Black Album was an attempt to recapture the energy of his first recording, Reasonable Doubt, when the artist was doing, quote-unquote, what came naturally. Kanye West, who contributed production to the Black Album, told Elizabeth Mendez Berry that Jay-Z, quote, wanted to take it back to before he was in the industry, to the drug game, to make it how Reasonable Doubt was. Indeed, in response to the violent ending of the video for 99 Problems, Jay-Z told MTV censors that the violence was symbolic, the death of Jay-Z and the birth of Sean Carter. But whereas many of the comments are framed as Jay-Z looking back, I am arguing that the grandiose way that Jay-Z presents his murder with striking finality is about the future of Sean Carter, not his past. The symbolic death of Jay-Z allows for what scholar Greg Demetriades calls a discursive rebirth. Writing about reactions to the death of Tupac Shakur, Demetriades explains that, quote, when Tupac was shot and killed, he was discursively reborn, his life and music becoming fodder for a range of myths from the mundane to the implausible, performed and reperformed in unpredictable ways. With the death of Jay-Z in the video for 99 Problems, I am arguing that Jay-Z and Sean Carter, used interchangeably accordingly to how each resonates in distinct markets, are discursively reborn and thus open to forms of critical exegesis that progressively challenge the status quo within commercial hip-hop and black masculinity. In other words, it is discursively rendered Jay-Z that can make hip-hop cosmopolitanism plausible. Thank you.
We will now begin the question and answer session of the program. If you do have a question, please indicate so to either Andrew or myself by raising your hand and then wait for a microphone before beginning to speak. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Mark. I was wondering if you could situate some of the what you're calling sort of the hip-hop metrosexuality within... Do you situate it within sort of larger traditions of African-American masculine elegance? And
yeah.
I'm thinking that hip-hop has so much of that, especially early hip-hop.
I think, you know, the running joke about the images of Dr. Dre and DJ Yella, you know, in the 1980s wearing their shiny suits, you know, when folks are making fun of that particular look. And, of course, that look makes sense, you know, given their interest in funk music. And what bands like Parliament Funkadelic dressed in, what Earth, Wind & Fire dressed in, it would make sense that as an 18 or 19-year-old who's trying to get into the music industry, Dr. Dre would dress that way. So yes, there's a larger trajectory, right, that we can connect this to. But I think what separates hip-hop from this conversation is the way that hyper-masculinity is, in fact, policed within hip-hop. We don't have that same measure of policing occurring in other forms of black artistic expression. It's clearly there, obviously, right? You know, performances of black masculinity that teeter too much towards a feminine, you know, right? What essentially happened to Sylvester, right? You know, programmers who were uncomfortable with the fact that Sylvester so much pushed the gender boundaries, right, from masculine to feminine. So there are obviously examples of that. But the way that hip-hop is policed around hyper-masculinity, I think, makes it a very different space, right? So you can have literally someone like Cam'ron come after Jay-Z simply because he's wearing sandals, right? And I think that is tremendously different, right? Which I think is why it's interesting that see figures like Kanye and Andre 3000, and even to a lesser extent someone like Sean Combs, kind of push the boundaries. Common's another good example of that, because they clearly are pushing the boundaries in a way that challenges kind of the status quo performance, you know, within hip-hop. The way hip-hop has dealt with the reality of them, right, because as they're pushing these boundaries, they're also selling a bunch of records, so hip-hop can't really jettison them fully, you know, from the camp, if you will, you know, is to argue that they are a product of certain kinds of eccentricities, right? In the case of Common and Andre 3000, they literally can put this at the feet of Erykah Badu, right? They're like this because they were with this woman, right? So we'll give them a pass. We'll give them a pass on this. Kanye is a different kind of figure in that regard, right? And on the one hand, you know, Beanie Siegel being the one exception, I think just in a common everyday reality in hip-hop, most cats can't really come after Kanye because they need his production, right? I mean, there's a direct correlation, and I think he gets away with it because no one has ever taken Kanye seriously as just a rapper, right? That's not why people listen to Kanye, right? It's this whole kind of production piece of it. And I think he even responds to some of these tensions. I think his move towards auto-tune, right? It's him trying to mask and trying to negotiate this space of his. I thought it was always interesting, you know, the lead video for the 808 album, right, where he uses the auto-tune, he debuts the video on Ellen. And I think that's an interesting choice for him, right? Clearly, he's made the decision that he doesn't need hip-hop the same way, right, that he has a broader audience, so he doesn't have to play to hip-hop's masculine politics the same way as some of the artists might have to.
Hi. What differences do you see where hip-hop is going now with new rappers? And like,
Perhaps you should answer that question. You know, I've been trying to get off the train for about 5 years. I swore it when 50 Cent emerged that I was done. Because I couldn't accept a marketing campaign was that you had to almost get shot to death in order to sell records. I mean, for me, that was telling me I need to get off, you know, the train at this point. But even 50 Cent has turned into a really compelling figure for me. One, because, you know, he's been very open about how you sell 10 million records, right? And one of the ways that you sell 10 million records is to sell to everybody in the room. And by everybody in the room, that means you you know, construct yourself not even just for obvious heterosexual gaze, right, and not for the gaze of the hip-hop thug community, right, but you actually construct yourself for the gaze of men who like looking at other men, right? And he's been very conscious of that. You know, when you show up on the cover of Vibe magazine with no shirt on and you're all greased up, you know, we can't believe that in this moment that the only people who are buying the magazine are women who think that 50 Cent is sexy, right? And he knows that. Or the fact that, you know, this is someone who is worth $600 million with half of the talent of any of the other men who have amassed, I'm talking Jay-Z and even Sean Combs in this context, in a shorter period of time, right? You know, 50 Cent needs to be teaching business classes at the Wharton School, right? He's worth six, you know, I mean, think about this, right? His first album is released in 2003. 7 years later, he's worth $500 million, right? How does that happen? And part of it is that, you know, he sat down, and like Jay-Z would sit down with Steve Stout, he sat down with Chris Lighty, and they laid down a marketing plan, right, which included buying real estate, which also includes, you know, investing in that damn vitamin water, you know, before it gets sold to Coca-Cola, right? And the numbers are that, you know, he generated anywhere from $10 million to to $250 million in the sale, right? Probably closer to the $10 million, but still, right? You know, David Wright, the third baseman for the New York Mets, got a piece of that also, right? So it's been all these kind of wise business decisions because he recognized that what this was just that. Right, it was a brand for him. It was a way for him to establish the brand. And once he established that brand, then he can sell clothes. He can sell sneakers. He can sell his books, right? Because he has a book publishing house, right? A little boutique book label, right? That out of one of the major book publishers, that he doesn't write it, but they do this street fiction stuff, the films and that whole thing. You know, so what hip hop means for me now is that I'm much less interested in the musical side of it, right? Mainstream hip-hop musically is produced for 17-year-olds, right? I have no interest in that, right? And I don't necessarily say that because I have an interest in listening to bad production from the 1980s. For all that we talk about how great hip-hop was in the 80s and great lyricists, you can't listen to four or five of those songs in a row because the production is so awful. And for all the complaints we make now about how cats aren't saying nothing, right? Right, you know, don't let me get started on Soulja Boy. Right? For all you want to say about what they're saying and putting out into the world, the production of contemporary hip hop is absolutely astounding. Right? Say what you will about 50 Cent. 20 years from now, In the Club is going to come on the radio, and everybody in the room is going to be dun dun. Right? Right? Just simply because Dr. Dre's production is so brilliant. So I think there's so many other things to talk about in hip-hop beyond the music now. You know, Ernie Panicoli, who is one of the most well-known photographers of hip-hop, Native American cat, grew up in New York. You know, his running joke is that rap music is the bastard child of hip-hop, right? It's the piece that got away, got commercialized, that's no longer part of it, right? But if you go back and you look at all the elements are still very strong and still very vibrant and doing very creative things, right? The fact that we can talk about a hip-hop theater movement, right? The fact that we can talk about a vibrant hip-hop feminism, right, given how misogynistic and sexist hip-hop comes off. I mean, there's so many other ways to enter into the conversation of hip-hop, including the fact that if we were to think about hip-hop being its age, right, almost 40 years old, right, if hip-hop was an actual adult right now, right, it'll be paying a 401k, it'd be paying mortgages, two car notes, planning for retirement, I mean, doing all those kinds of things that adults do. Public conversation about hip-hop, particularly in mainstream news, infantilizes hip-hop, right? Continues to talk about the 17-year-old who's listening to Soulja Boy as if that's the only narrative that's occurring within hip-hop, right? Hip-hop elected a president 2 years ago, right? And let's be clear about that, right? And not because he was walking around saying, I'm listening to Jay-Z on my iPod, but because 15 years ago, rap wasn't afraid to go to Lily White America, right? One of the first major hip-hop conferences in academe was not held at New York University, was not held at USC, it was held at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, right? In 1993, 1994, hip-hop was not afraid to go to middle America, right? And those white kids who were listening to hip-hop in those days listened to it, took it seriously, so that when someone presented a black man to them
15 years later run for president, they didn't have to think twice about that, right? Because they've been listening and really taking seriously narratives coming from Black America for 15 years, right? That's how Barack Obama got elected, right? The fact that then he could convince Black folks who never vote to actually come out to vote, you know, is another particular dynamic of it. So I think, you know, commercially, and that's dying now too, because, you know, the record industry model is fundamentally broke, right? Digital music has changed everything, right? Folks don't need record labels anymore because they don't need distribution anymore, right? As long as you can make your music available on iTunes, right? You know, like my former student, Mike Posner, right, who's this combination hip-hop Justin Timberlake thing, right? You know, his first album was available on iTunes, right? He didn't have a label deal. He didn't sign with Jay, right, until 2 years after he drops his album on iTunes. So it's a different world. And what that means is that without the labels dictating what it's going to be, you are getting some elements of much more creative things. So one of the things you listened to when you came in is an album by Georgia Muldrew. And she's, you know, from the South. Her father is a great pianist, late pianist. Her mother is a kind of Baptist minister type and singer in her own right. And she's been producing all this incredible music, Georgia Ann Muldrow, for the last 5 or 6 years below the radar. And she's finally getting some mainstream sensibilities, right? But the album that we played wasn't just her performing, but she does all the production, right? When have we ever heard about women producers in hip-hop, right? And it's the kind of thing that I think can only occur in this moment where labels aren't dictating how women are going to be presented within the context of hip-hop, right? So now we have a very prominent woman, right, who's behind the boards in something that we rarely have seen in the context of hip-hop, right? And then, of course, we got to deal with the Soulja Boys. You know, I'm looking at the crowd, and if I ask you to raise your hands and tell me to say that you know what Supermaning is, I imagine, you know, virtually everyone under the age of 25 will raise their hands and they go, they know, right? Anybody over the 25 years old will go, like, what's Supermaning, right? And we're on tape, so I can't tell you, right? Ask one of your students tomorrow, what's Supermaning, right? Let me just say it has something to do with an excretion, a woman's back, and a sheet being stuck to it. And I'll just leave it at that. Right? And the problem is not even that Soulja Boy is singing this narrative, right? But Soulja Boy at the time is 16 or 17 years old, and we have to raise the question, why does he even know what this narrative is, right? So I can't even blame him, right? He's a kid. I can't blame him. Why does he even have knowledge of this kind of narrative to be able to perform it on record? And, you know, it's all over urban radio because they change up the lyrics, right? And it's like, what's he talking about? And then finally the kids tell them, it's like, oh, my God, right? Why are we playing this on the radio? Well, yeah, exactly, right? And it's not that contemporary hip-hop is any more profane than previous examples, right? You know, Jelly Roll Morgan got a track called Go Get Me a Pallet. You know, Robin Kelly writes about this in his book Race Rebels, right? And you listen to read some of the lyrics of Go Get Me a Pallet, right? You know, Lil Wayne will blush, right, reading these lyrics, right? But Jelly Roll Morton could perform that song, right, with an adult audience where everybody understood what the dynamics are. You know, now you got profane lyrics being blasted on urban radio stations 3 o'clock in the afternoon when you're driving back from school in the minivan with your kids, right? And that's a very different dynamic. Long answer to your question.
Hi. I'm going to try to get away from the Superman song, get off that topic. I was wondering if you think hypermasculinity can be performed by a female performer. I'm thinking of Beyoncé's image, and one of her songs is called Diva, and it's a diva is a female version of a hustler. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of her videos, she wears armor, and it seems almost like your hypermasculinity. And I was wondering if you could talk about her.
You know, in the early days of hip-hop, there was no way for women to be in hip-hop and be on the map, on the mic, without performing some version of hypermasculinity. That's what framed Latifah in the early days. It definitely framed MC Light, particularly because she had a deeper voice. It really isn't until the Little Kim and Foxy Brown generation, and to a lesser extent, you know, Salt and Pepper before that, that the way that women could be in hip-hop became feminized the way that we understand it today. But even figures like Jean Grey,
or even Missy Elliott, right? You know, Missy Elliott, you know, came into hip hop, and she clearly was never comfortable performing a certain kind of femininity, even though that didn't keep her label from wanting her to lose 25 pounds and all these kinds of things. So that stuff is real. I think not even talking about Beyonce's performance of it. You know, Beyonce, you know, folks have a love-hate relationship with Beyonce. And lots of reasons, right? I mean, Beyonce is an incredible self-promoter. But she's also particularly gifted and talented, though not in the ways that we normally will recognize that gift and that talent. You know, just in terms of her vocal talents, right? There's not anyone who works as hard at Beyonce to sing, right? And what that means, and you know, we all respond to the quality of the voice, but listen to the way that she paces herself throughout bars, right? This is like incredible rhythm to her singing, right? The way she speeds up before notes. I mean, just the incredible stuff that's going on, right? Above just simply singing the song that knows how she is, right? And of course now she's taking that energy to the imagery level, right? So when you talk about Video Phone, right, and the video she's done with Lady Gaga and her fascination with Betty Page, right? And you know, the thing about this kind of pinup image, I mean, one of the ways that these pinups were interesting is that Betty Page was so sexualized, right, that it was almost as if she was performing masculine desire, right? If you can imagine women being so endowed that they were almost equipped with a phallus, right? And so Beyonce is moving within to that realm in terms of the kind of performance that she's doing. Of course, you know, if I was a boy, if I was a girl, this kind of idea of code switching, stuff that she and Jay-Z have been doing for a long time, right? If you go back to 03, Bonnie and Clyde, right, I mean, that video is all about this idea of subtle little gender shifts in their performance, right? You know, them wearing each other's clothes, their reference to the Prince riff, you know, the bridge to Bonnie and Clyde 03 is Prince's song, If I Was Your Girlfriend. Prince originally recorded that song back in 1986. He was planning to do a whole album of an artist called Camille. Camille was Prince's vocals sped up to a higher pitch so that he would sound like a woman. The only songs that made that process were a couple of tracks that are on Sign of the Times, including, you know, If I Was Your Girlfriend, right? So that when you listen to If I Was Your Girlfriend, it is very hard to tell, right, what the gender address is. It could be a man talking to a man, a woman talking to a woman. I mean, it's conflicted, right? And so what makes Jay-Z and Beyonce decide we're going to grab that hook, right, given the kind of cultural DNA that's there? So I think she's always been there doing that kind of work. I think the most visceral example of this, you know, comes from The Wire. You know, Felicia Snoop Pearson, right, who played Snoop on The Wire. And, you know, this is a real woman. This is a woman who gets sent to jail for murder when she's 14 years old. She had been on the street selling drugs, you know, for 3 years before then. And the only way that she could exist on those corners was to perform a hyper-masculinity, right? She had to be a dude. And to her detriment, when she gets accused of murder, right, and she goes up in front of the grand jury, right, they decide to try her as an adult, right? Because as a 14-year-old who looked like a man, they did not believe that she was an underage criminal, right? Right? They wouldn't try her that way. She got tried as an adult because of her performance of hypermasculinity. And of course, she translated that into some success, you know, once she got out of jail on The Wire. And I think Beyonce is playing with that. I'm curious to see where Beyonce goes, right? Because on some level, Beyonce can't do any more musically, right? You know, so, you know, her future is going to be what she does in terms of video presentation, what kind of button she can push, to the point now that, you know, she's earned enough money and a respect in the industry that she doesn't have to sell records, right, which means she can do anything she wants at this point in time, kind of where Kanye is to a certain extent also. So I'm curious to see where that pushes, and where that pushes in relationship to Jay-Z, you know, who has been, as far as we know, largely absent, and how she has been publicly presenting herself, at least in terms of her work.
In the topical background here, it mm-hmm. says that, like, hip-hop culture has become the target of concerns about the representation of women. And so I wanted to know, when you showed us Jay-Z's videos, the first video that you showed us, Excuse Me, Miss,
yeah.
The worst that we saw was a girl had just, like, a ripped dress. But he was bringing her to all these great places, had cars and everything out for her. But then when you came to 99 Problems, it's like, oh, this girl's a bitch. She's wearing, like, bra and panties or whatever bathing suit that was. And it's like a whole different connotation when you're in the hood or when you're living, like, the good life. So I just wanted to know, like, what do you feel he's trying to say about women, or where does he stand on that?
I think 99 Problems is very complicated in that regard. I mean, he has this whole line in the song about bitches and pussy. And before, when he first recorded that song, and Elizabeth Mendez Berry writes about this, she did an essay that was published in Vibe on Jay-Z before he released the Black Album that eventually was included in the Best Music articles for 2003. And she asked him pointedly about the use of that lyric, right? And they had a long conversation about it. And in fact, he changed the lyric to try to present some context for it, right? You know, with that whole line where he says, you know, it's not about a bitch having a pussy, but a pussy acting like a bitch, right? Trying to, you know, decouple, you know, this idea of female sexuality from actual female bodies. How successful he is at that is a whole other question. I think what makes 99 Problems complicated in that regard is that very often when you think about the standard fare in terms of hip-hop videos, I mean, all you get are these examples of these women. I mean, that's what the whole video is. I think where the video tends to complicate this, and this is Mark Romanek mainly, is by presenting all of this other imagery in relationship to these images of women in the video, right? So the video, you don't leave the video, right, with the sense that it was just about naked women. Right, there's so many more images for you to consider within that context, and I think that was a way for Romanek to talk about, you know, Jay-Z's cosmopolitanism in that regard. One of the reasons why I chose Jay-Z as a figure to do this labor, you know, because I immediately expect whenever this book comes out next year, right, the response is going to be like, why Jay-Z, right? And folks will go through a long litany in history of Jay-Z's lyrics and Jay-Z's videos, right? Why would you pick Jay-Z? And for me, it goes back to his video for Girls, 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 right, which is released on the Blueprint 2001. The video starts, and the video is just about him talking about, I got this woman here, I got this woman there, et cetera, right? Standard hip-hop fare. You get three quarters into the video, the camera pans back, right, and literally exposes that it's a set, right? Cardboard, you know, this kind of housing apartment where he has all these women. It literally shows that this is a cardboard cutout. Right, you start to see all the people working behind the scenes cross into the frame. Jay-Z finishes his rap, right, and walks off the set. All the women that were supposedly his women in the video are sitting in director's chairs. He walks by and say, hey, great job, I enjoyed working with you, right? Just normal little casual banter, right? And it's a small little gesture, right? These aren't really his women, right? These were actresses, right? At some point, as he's walking off the set, he takes off his shirt as if he was literally taking off his uniform. And eventually, he walks off the set to a door that says Jay-Z closed set. And what the video is about is just simply making a simple gesture, right? Jay-Z is a commodity. Sean Carter is a person. They're not one and the same, right? And what struck me about that, because, you know, I'm not trying to claim that Jay-Z's a feminist because of that, right? What I'm trying to claim is that because of the way hip-hop polices hypermasculinity, what we actually have to pay attention to when we read hip-hop are those small gestures, right? Those small gestures, in fact, are incredibly meaningful within the ways that hip-hop masculinity is performed, right? And how do we get to the point where we affirm cats who are willing to make those gestures so that they can make bigger and deeper gestures down the road, right? So that when you see him in 03 Bonnie and Clyde, right, you get him articulating a further gesture in that regard, right? When you get to Kingdom Come, and you listen to his track Minority Report, right? I don't know if any of you have ever heard Minority Report, right? And I think this is important in talk about, you know, what these artists are confronting. You know, Minority Report, for all intents and purposes, is Jay-Z's first conscious rap recording, right? At least in terms of being mainstream available, right? It is his critique of the reactions to Katrina, right? And he begins with, you know, all this kind of interesting data about what people didn't do. He talks about the stuff that he saw down there. He talks about the fact very openly, you know, all these rappers, you know, running around talking about they're trying to get their houses on cribs, but no one is responding to this crisis in New Orleans, right? He goes, yeah, me and Puff gave $1 million, right? But me and Puff didn't give our time, right? interesting kind of self-critical moment. Then he goes on to, not only did we give our time, we gave our money to the same people who couldn't deliver services in the first place, right? And it's like, okay, that's an interesting pause, right? Not only is he affirming a certain kind of political consciousness, but also being self-critical of his inability to perform that, right? You never heard that song because it never got played on the radio, right? If Jay-Z can't get a conscious hip-hop recording played on the radio, nobody can. All right. And of course, the work for those of us who do this critical work is that we actually really need to pay attention to these gestures, right? You're right? So that there is a space fruitful in the culture for them to respond to these things. The reality is that, you know, Jay-Z, or let me use Snoop Dogg as a great example, right? You know, Snoop is a real complicated cat anyway, right? All right. But if any of you have ever seen any episode of Fatherhood, right? Snoop Dogg's two-season E! Entertainment Channel show about fatherhood, right? It is an amazing thing, right? Because whether or not it's a performance or not, because even if it's a performance, we have to ask the reasons why, he performs Cliff Huxtable in a way that Cliff Huxtable wouldn't recognize, right? Really traditional investments in parenthood, right? The kind of stuff that makes you think, well, what? Is this really Snoop, right? And even if it's not real, what's his investment in the performance? Right, of performing such a mainstream version of black fatherhood, right? And again, it's a simple attempt to say Snoop Dogg is a product, right? Calvin Broaddus is an actual guy who has kids, right? You know, ESPN 7 years ago, right? Let's go watch Snoop coach Snoop, right? Because Snoop decided that he was going to fund and support a Little League football team, right? And folks are just going, well, you know, that's kind of Snoop performing for the camera. The kids who started on Snoop's team 6 or 7 years ago, those kids grew up and won the city football championship in Los Angeles, and half of them are going to college because Snoop Dogg made an intervention. No one ever talks about that kind of stuff. So we need to find a way to affirm these gestures, right? Snoop and Jay-Z, they ain't never sat in a feminist theory class. They don't know who Patricia Hill Collins is, right? Don't know who Angela Davis is, right? When David Banner, who's a bright guy, right? David Banner is a thesis away from a master's degree, right? In public policy. Folks don't know that, right? When David Banner and Mike Eric Dyson, and what's his name from New Orleans, Master P, go in front of Bobby Rush's House committee that's going to look at the demonization of black women in their images, right? This is in the aftermath of IMUS, right? And David Banner presents a written statement, right? And he makes some interesting claims in that written statement, right? Including the fact he goes, look, every year I take 75 kids for a tour of historically black colleges and universities, right? So they can think about what schools they may want to go to. Mainstream news never covers that, right? If I was to go out and shoot another rapper today, that'd be on all the newscasts, right? So the question is, well, why do you perform the kind of lyrics that you do? Because those lyrics make money, right? And I could do something else and I wouldn't make any money. His argument was, I perform this profane and sexist and misogynist stuff because it makes me money, but I'm putting that money back into the community, right? And David Banner was incredible during the Katrina thing, right? The people that he rallied around and money that he raised, et cetera, et cetera. And it's an interesting dynamic, right? And I kept thinking to some of my colleagues, right? That's interesting. I have a problem with it. We need to send him a feminist care package, all right? Because David Banner is smart enough to know, right, and is thoughtful enough that if we send him copies of Black Feminist Thought, and if we send him copies of Blues Legacies, right, if we send him a care package of feminist writings, right, from men and women, he might actually sit down and read those things, and it becomes a kind of intervention that needs to be made, right? But if we simply dismiss out of hand his reaction as sexist and misogynistic, we never create the space to make that kind of intervention. Which is why I'm not upset at Tyler Perry necessarily for doing a version of For Colored Girls, right, who considered suicide when the rainbow is enough, right? And, you know, you all watch Tyler Perry films. I mean, that's a scary proposition, right? Here is this play, right, which is the cornerstone of black feminist thought over the last 30 years, into Saki Zhange's, you know, groundbreaking core poem, right? And of course, she signed off on it because she knows, right, that if it doesn't get done now, it's not going to get done,
And the only person who can actually get it done is Tyler Perry, right? And of course, folks are up in arms, and legitimately so. Aren't there any women directors that can do it? Well, hell, as far as Whitaker did, Waiting to Exhale, right? Is there anybody else who can do this film, right? And it's like, well, yes, but no one will go see it. And it won't get a marketing budget. And it won't get promoted. Yes, I'd love Cassie Lemons to direct for Colored Girls, right? But Cassie Lemons has sold 1/20th in terms of film sales of what Tyler Perry's going to do on Why Did I Get Married Too? Right? That's the reality, right? But then there's the hope that him working with that book will become the kind of intervention in his filmmaking process, right, that allows him to grow up and mature, right? And so you can only hold out that kind of hope. So, I'm big on gestures. I think I mentioned gestures about 10 times in this piece, right? We need to find a way to affirm and recognize what are simply gestures in our world, right? But in a world that polices hip-hop and polices masculinity the way it does, we have to take those gestures seriously, right? And again, going back to Jay-Z and Cameron, open-toe sandals, right, became a reason to blast him in a hip-hop song. And ageism, right? It's like 42 years old, right? Open-toed sandals with jewels on it, right? You know, you're done, right? You can't be in hip-hop anymore because you're wearing open-toed sandals, right? Like, so you got cats walking around on beaches with Timberland on, right? 107 degrees, right? Walking around with Timberland and bathing suits on, right? Because that's a performance, of a certain kind of performance of masculinity.
We have time for one more question.
Could you speak a little bit to how you mentioned Common and you talked a little bit about conscious hip-hop, and I'm wondering how you understand, especially in this kind of like leverage space that you're talking about, how you understand Common and Mos Def and some folks who've been able to kind of work in that transition with relationship to these discourses of masculinity. I'm kind of, I don't know. I'm just thinking about that.
Yeah. Clearly, whenever we talk about conscious hip-hop, we're talking consciousness only in relationship to racial politics. Because most of these cats are fundamentally backward on issues of gender. Right? Common, for all we want to say about how great he's been, he was probably the most pronounced homophobic in hip-hop until 5 years ago. Right? I mean, he was more homophobic than the cats that we obviously think of homophobic, right? Because he felt he had to perform homophobia as a way for him to be taken seriously in an arena of masculinity, right? So he went out of his way to be homophobic until someone makes an intervention, right? People close to him start dying off, you know, Erica's whispering in his ear. I mean, all that kind of stuff, whatever the case was. So I think it's problematic for us to only think about consciousness in hip-hop as it relates to racial politics, right? And we have rarely seen male hip-hop artists really on point in any kind of way around gender politics or particularly sexuality politics, right? You know, Kanye hasn't done it in his music. He's done it in interviews, right? But it hasn't translated into the music. So I think, you know, where do we find, and that's why I think the whole notion of hip-hop feminism is so interesting, right? Because arguably, the only time that we even talk about gender and sexuality, misogyny and homophobia in black communities is in relationship to hip-hop, right? And what do you do? You know, in some ways, you know, it's my see Dolores Tucker argument. If you see Dolores Tucker in 1992 and you go, you hate hip-hop, and you've never listened to it, and you've never loved it, right? Well, it's easy to say you're hip-hop, right? Hold it accountable when you love it. Right? And hip-hop feminism has done that extraordinarily over the last 10 or 15 years, right? So much so that contemporarily, right, on a serious intellectual level, we can't even talk about hip-hop without acknowledging the intervention that hip-hop feminism has made, right? Unfortunately, that intervention has not necessarily translated into some of the mainstream artists, right? I think the fact that you have a Jolda and Muldrew, right, who can produce a whole hip-hop album performed by men, right, including Kool G Rap. You know, Kool G Rap would be the one who basically brutally beat his then wife, Kareem Stephens. You know, it's this interesting kind of juxtaposition in that context. I think clearly there have been inroads, right? I don't think we've seen it in the lyrical context, unless it's been like Ludacris's work with Mary J. Blige,
you know, talking about domestic violence, right? The track that he did with her talking about. I mean, you have those kind of obvious examples, right? So you will have cats who will step out and obviously talk about things like sexual violence, right? In some cases, we'll talk about just plain domestic violence, right? But in terms of actually articulating a coherent feminist perspective in the music, right, I think we need to make those, that's where we need to make those kind of interventions, right? I think we need to create a more loving space to talk to some of these artists, right? And to do so in a way where we acknowledge, right, that first of all, much of what they do is performance, right? I mean, when you listen to the Carter Three, and I was never a big Lil Wayne fan, you know, what sold me on Lil Wayne was his voice, right? You know, Lil Wayne is the person that you have the conversation about, you know, about content versus form. Right, because Lil Wayne's about form. Right, we keep listening because we think about hip hop as all being about content. We listen to Lil Wayne for content, and the content is nonsense. Right, but if we think about Lil Wayne in the context of form, right, there's something extraordinary occurring. Right, but he has this one song on the Carter Three called "Misunderstand." Right, it's the last track. Right, and very consciously, the sample is Nina Simone's. Right, "Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood." And he doesn't rap; he talks for 10 minutes. Right. And he dropped stuff like, I was watching the news the other night. This white guy was on television talking about the fact that there were more black men in prison than there are in college. And he's like, damn, I can't believe that, right? And then the second thought was, damn, why is this white guy telling me this? Right? Why has anybody black ever mentioned this to me? Why am I watching a white guy on television introduce this to me, right? And then he goes on Al Sharpton, right? Al Sharpton's running around talking about hip-hop this, hip-hop that, right? If you were a decent human being, before you went ranting about hip-hop, you'd sit down and have a conversation with me. Because that's what decent human beings do. And I was like, damn. Right? There's something really logical about that, right? So much so that you almost have to ask yourself, well, yeah, why has anybody done it, right? But it's those kind of moments, right? And that's a song that's not going to be played on the radio. It's not the song that's going to be downloaded on iTunes. Right, because that's what the iTunes environment has also created, right? No one buys albums anymore. You buy the four hot tracks you like, which usually means the three hot tracks you heard on the radio, right? And the fourth track that somebody told you about, right? And all the other stuff gets left alone, right? So, you know, cats are thinking in much more complex ways than we ever give them credit for. But I think we have to create much more of a space, right, to be able to push the discourse, you know, in further directions, right? And there were earlier moments, right? You know, when Ice Cube, folks, most of y'all don't know anything about it, when Ice Cube sat down with Bell Hooks, right, back in 1993, in her book, and the text is in her book, Outlaw Culture, right? She sat down with Ice Cube and was like, okay, what's this about, right? We need many more moments like that, right? What would it be like to do a book project, right? And we can't even talk about that anymore, right? What would it do to do a series of podcasts where you had prominent feminists sitting down talking openly with hip-hop artists, right? What would that look like, right? What could be gained out of pushing the discussion in that kind of direction, the way that, you know, Bell Hooks and Ice Cube, you know, pointed us to 15, 16, 17 years ago?
Clark Forum Student Project Managers, the Clark Forum Student Board and Student Senate, I would like to thank you again, Professor Neal, for coming. Also, I would like to remind everyone that this is only the first event of our hip-hop symposium. Tomorrow at 12:30 here in the CERN Great Room, we'll have hip-hop artist Shantae, Paradigm Smiles, discuss Pick Up the Mic, an award-winning documentary on the homo hop scene in which she was featured. At 2 p.m., we'll have a student panel discussion on the culture of hip-hop. And at 4 p.m., a faculty panel will discuss the lecture we just heard. And then in culmination of the symposium, we'll feature Hip Hop in Action at 7 p.m. in Anita Tuvenschlechter Auditorium. Thank you all for coming, and I hope to see you guys tomorrow. Thanks.